This is Radical Love Life, an ongoing series of podcasts and special events where we explore faith outside the boxes. Hosted by Mark Dilcom and Kelly Wilson.
Hey, Mark.
Hey, Kelly.
How are you this week?
I am just freaking awesome as always. How are you, my friend?
Awesome. I'm good too. I'm good too. I'm glad it's close to the weekend.
Yes.
But doing very well. Very well.
I'm happy to hear that. In the family, everybody's doing well?
Yeah, we are doing well. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Excellent. Excellent.
What are we talking about this week, Mark?
Well, my beloved friend, we have a special guest for this episode. Matthew Labonka is joining us. Hello, Matthew.
Hey, fellas. Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you.
Welcome, 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 Matthew. So for a quick tee up, Matthew is the creator of a play called Communion, which is biographical, right, about your experiences. And Matthew is here to share about that, talk about his own faith journey, and just have a great conversation overall. So Matthew, I'm going to start off with the first tee this up based about the play itself, Communion, which I've seen twice now. And I deeply moved. It just connects with me because of it's your story about what happens, which we're going to dig into. And I see the authenticity that you bring. Yourself is never lost in that. And it's a story of hope. That's like just of you. And that's my take of it, along with everything else that goes to that. But let me ask you, what is your message in Communion?
Communion's message is that the church is there, ideally, to love all people, and, you know, just to give it a little bit of context, if that's okay.
Go for it.
So I'm a Broadway actor, came to New York City in my 20s with Broadway dreams. A lot of them were realized. But when I got into my 40s, I said, you know, I want to do a little bit more. I want to grow some more roots. And I'd grown up in the Catholic Church, and I was always a musician. And as an actor, I wound up never having to wait a table in my life. Never had to tend bar because I know it's quite a miracle in itself, isn't it? But I never had to do that because my survival jobs always came out of church work, out of religious institutions, primarily out of the Catholic Church, though not exclusively. And I was a musician. I played the organ, and one thing would lead to another where I would meet the community. This was all in my neighborhood, actually, in Woodside, Queens. And I also wound up teaching within the Catholic school system there as well. I grew up Catholic, but I never went to Catholic school per se. So Communion is the story of how I was fired from the Catholic Church, from those jobs simultaneously in 2021 in autumn, almost 2 years to the day, really, where we're recording this, for marrying my husband. Based on the Catholic Church's stances on same-sex marriage. And the message of Communion, There's a lot of messages, I would say, but one thing that I'm hearing that keeps resonating with my audience is one line in particular where we say that the church is not God.
I laugh, not because it's funny, but I mentioned that is a striking line in that. And I was like, that is absolutely true. The church is not.
So that's in a nutshell why we're here, because my show is currently in the midst of a developmental production at the Cell Theater on 23rd Street in New York City. The Cell is a bit of an incubator, and they foster all sorts of new types of work, whether it's visual art or theatrical art or dance and all sorts of. There's the Broadway show called Paradise Square that actually got its start at the Cell Theater.
I did not know that. And yeah. I've seen that.
Yeah. Wow. My director actually was one of the original creatives on that team. She's also the artistic director of the Cell Theater. Her name's Kira Simring. She's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Nancy Manajerian is the woman who started the Cell Theater. It's in this beautiful renovated townhouse. And the inside, when you walk in, there's like a huge light plot, and there's a back garden, and there's upper floors as well. They do a lot of wonderful things. And I was very fortunate to be handpicked for a residency to develop the show before we actually make its world premiere. Although the response has been pretty wonderful, overwhelming. We sold out our initial run. We had to extend. We sold out the extension.
Yeah.
And we added additional performances, and we're almost sold out actually now, going into our closing weekend tonight. We have a show tonight.
You do.
And by the time your listeners hear this, the show will have, the developmental production will have closed, but we have hopes to bring it further. And I know later in the conversation, I'm sure that we'll be discussing.
Oh, I'm sure we will. You mentioned it, Kira, and you know, I personally believe that things happen for reasons that we don't understand. Some might call that synchronicity. That's a good word for it, I suppose. But that's how I found you, was because of Kira, in an indirect way, because I met her parents at a wedding in Boston, because Kira is related to a very good friend of my husband, Roy, who they go way, way, way back. But I didn't know any of this until the night that I saw the first time I saw the performance, because it was a friend of Roy and mine who happened to mention, oh, there's this thing called communion that's taking place at the Cell, and when it's about this, because he knows the work I'm doing as well. It's like, you might be interested. You want to go? And I said, sure, get us tickets. And so when we arrived at the door to wait for the door open, I actually asked, not Kira, but Mara, said, is your dad Steve? And she's like, no. I think, and it took us a moment, and she realized I was actually asking about Kira, and then unfolded that here all this comes together. So here's your director who has this connection to us. And anyway, I love the fact though that how I got there to see communion and what brought us to have this conversation together, synchronicity as it is. I want to ask you about growing up. There's one of the earlier scenes in the play about you and your mother, right? As I understand it, she is a Sunday school teacher.
She's actually, now long retired, but she was a nursery school teacher.
Nursery school teacher. Mm-hmm. Okay.
A nursery school. And the school was in the church hall of the local Catholic church where I grew up. And she was my teacher. And, you know, the scene chronicles how, when I was young, I used to play. I loved to play. And I would always race to the dress-up nook to play with this one perfect pocketbook. For your listeners that don't, some people say, what's a pocket? It's a purse, right? So I'd put the pocketbook. Here in the Northeast, we would say a pocketbook in New York. And I'd put it on and let my hand just dang. I loved it, right? And I have visceral memories of myself, like holding my hand up, doing that. And when I got older, I would go upstairs to the church and I would keep playing, but I wasn't playing with playing dress up anymore, although I was an altar boy. But when I was a teenager, the organ, my father is a retired music teacher, whole family of educators. My brother is a principal in Connecticut. I would just play the organ, and I would, when I went away to my university for college, I played at my college church. That was like my solvency job there. And then when I got to New York, I started getting recruited for all these singing jobs because I was a good sight reader, and I sang for I sang for a synagogue. I sang for different churches, and then I wound up singing in my neighborhood and playing the organ and leading the choir. And I just kept playing. So that's like the story of, you know, we have a Glockenspiel that we open the show with. And it sounds like whenever you're in a theater, you hear ding dong, ding dong. Yeah. And that's like where everybody's supposed to sit down. But but we hear that sound and we laugh about it because I tell the audience, I address them as my choir because Kira had the wonderful notion to have a huge, as she lovingly says, I wanted a huge lesbian sing-along. She said, I want a big sing-along. And so I said, let's do it. Let's do it. And there's nothing that could have set the story up better to introduce me as a teacher and as a musician than to lead this audience in song. And I was hesitant because I didn't trust that people would sing, right?
I yeah. didn't trust that a theater audience in New York would sing. Boy, was I wrong.
So, choir, come on. And they did. And of course they do every night. But I think it's also because of my years of experience as a teacher that I was able to craft that scene to get people to like shed any inhibition and to make sure that we were all in it together as a community. That's part of where we come up with the name Communion, because I know that when I lost my jobs, probably the hardest part of it, beyond any sense of betrayal of the church or rocking of faith or any of that, which was of course difficult, the hardest part was living within these communities and having the communities torn out from underneath me. And the singing, which happens a few times in the show as a communal effort, it's like you're back in choir rehearsal, you're back in high school or wherever you may have done something like that, and maybe you've never done something like that. And you're surrounded by people who have. And me, who does this for a living all the time. And it creates this magical feeling, especially in a space like the cell where it's not the biggest space.
Right.
It's like in the choir room together. It's been healing for me to do this and to work on this, in part because of some of those scenes, because you feel a connection with your audience. And you feel a sense of empathy and understanding that comes from doing something together and that comes from listening and participating to the music.
Yeah, I have a question to follow that up. Just thinking about the work that you did as a musician in all of those church environments was... if faith was a part of that work. I know that I've done a fair amount of work in churches, and there have been times when I worked in churches where I was part of the faith community. And there were times that I worked in churches where I was outside of that faith community and outside of faith altogether. So interested to see if that work, I mean, obviously it connected you with the community. If there was a faith element that threaded through all that work as well.
Absolutely was a faith element. And, you know, this harkens back, though, to when you were asking about my childhood and my upbringing, like being the child of teachers and parents who went to Catholic school, you know, but it was very normal. Like there was nothing fanatic about my religious upbringing, nothing over the top about it. It was just good living. And we'd go to church on Saturday night or Sunday morning, maybe sing in the choir. But it was just like part of the week. And, you know, I learned some wonderful values. And I remember, I always resonated with the Book of Psalms. You know, in the Catholic Mass, there's two readings and then the Gospel reading. But in between the first and the second reading, there is a psalm. And always. I always liked that. There always seemed to be some sort of a universal relatable truth within there. And I found that when I was a musician, as a player, those were often some of my favorite things as well. You know, the cantor, I would intone the psalm and then people would respond. And just, it was never to me, that in particular was never laden with dogma or doctrine. And a lot of the music, you know, as a music director, I was allowed to choose the music within the liturgy. And I often chose things that, either I loved it because of the melody or I loved it because of the simplicity of the text. And, you know, that, what's that phrase where they say, when you sing, you pray twice?
Oh, I'm not
familiar. Have you ever heard that? It's a very common thing.
No.
And church musicians will say, or you hear that in circles, like, when you sing, you pray twice. And it's just, music has a way of getting you into that wonderful zone that we all know what that is, when it, especially like when you're reading something or creating something, crafting something, whatever it is for you, and you're in that great zone. And I think that that for me was the strongest spiritual element for me, that I would feel like I'm in a place. You don't get there every time you do it, but a lot of times, you know, you're there. And and if you, and you hear the congregation maybe that didn't sing last year, like now they've gotten to know this melody per se, and now they're singing a little bit more. Or you have, I did a youth choir too, and you know, all of those things, it definitely enriched my sense of faith and my spiritual roots within this community. Even though, I mean, you know, full disclosure, like, duh, I know, and I knew that there were a lot of difficult and there were teachings that were at odds with the LGBTQ community. And I often would feel, what am I doing here? What am I doing here?
Yeah,
a girl's got to eat, you know, a girl's got to pay the rent. But like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
Do I need to find other ways? And sometimes I felt like I was selling out. We explore that a little bit within the piece as well.
You do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that, Matthew, because, you know, I didn't plan to ask a question around that, but and I don't see that, but it does make me wonder, you know, like you said, a girl's got to eat, but how was that for you personally though? Like, you know, in at the gut, you know, in your sacral area, you know, the conflict. I mean, how did you manage that?
Well, here was the thing though. Like when I was recruited for these jobs,
right?
I was literally playing the piano and singing in my apartment, and my next door neighbor came and knocked on my door and said, hey, we need a, I guess their church musician had either retired or, you know, didn't know, didn't keep a beat very well. There were a lot of different things that they're just like, we buddy knew. And right. So I was recruited and I met with the people and they said, we would love to. So I said, all right. And they gave me everything that I asked for. Cause you know, I came to the city to be an actor. I said, if I book a big project, I'm going to want to go out of town. But would it be okay if I left town, if I get a substitute and I'll take care of that, you know, I'll figure that out for you guys. And then when I'm done with the run of the show, I can come back. Oh, sure, Matthew, we can do that. They gave me health insurance. I'm vested in the pension plan within the Diocese of Brooklyn. You know, I had all these things that, and it was three blocks from my house and it's a survival job where I'm making music and I'm working with neighbors that I already know and who already know me and love me and know that I'm gay.
There's that.
Wow. Talk about opportunity knocking.
You know, we're in New York City. There's a fairly progressive mindset here. And so I trusted that. And I was at this job for years. But specifically, I was there for like 3 years when a parishioner at the church came to the organ after a 5 p.m. mass. And she said, you just did a great job. Sometimes I come when you do the children's choir. And, you know, I teach over at St. Joseph's School, like the other direction, the other side of the neighborhood. Hey, do you want a job? I said, a job doing what? And she said, teaching students music. And I had my degree as a music educator. I had done that in college. So I was certified, and but I didn't really use it. She said, do you want this job? And I said, no, it's okay. I said, I don't think I want this job. I'm busy enough. And I talked to a few people. They said, listen, the principal over there, he's really cool. He's really nice. You know, I'm going to talk to him. So I kind of begrudgingly went there and I was just about to turn 40. And, you know, a lot happens when you turn 40 and you start thinking about things. And the principal gave me everything that I asked for. I gave him the same list of things. Can I have this and this and this? Oh, sure, Matthew, we'll figure it out. And to his credit, Like when I booked a Broadway show in 2019, I did a production of A Christmas Carol at the Lyceum Theater here in New York City. And they let me go. It was seasonal. I was only gone for like two and a half months. I got the sub in and it was great, you know? And during all that time, like my then boyfriend, now husband, Rowan would, he didn't come to every mass. He wasn't Catholic. He didn't grow up with a religious faith or anything like that. Occasionally went to a Unitarian church with his mom, but there was, you know, nothing really, not like me. And he had even said, you know, the Catholic Church, you know, you hear all these things, the headlines in, and I mean, obviously he's right. You know, there's a lot of scandal that surrounds the church. And, you know, I would question that as well. But the silver lining was that the choir knew Rowan and my boss knew Rowan. And he even came to parties in the rectory. There was a lot of openness. I didn't go so far as to drape a pride flag over the organ, but but you know, I mean, at this point I'm saying, why the hell not? But I didn't do that, but I wasn't closeted by any means. I wasn't, you know, I would even laugh with some parishioners. There's this one guy, he's long since passed away now. I think he was a closeted gay man himself, but the organ was at the back of the church and there was a confessional back there right behind the organ that they had converted into like a closet. And I would put like the choir ropes in there. I would put the music in there. And sometimes I would just sit in there and just wait quietly and, you know, prepare until mass would start. And he would poke his head into the door sometimes and say, "Hey kid, you in the closet? You're in the closet." It was like open and it was silly. And I'm like, and I would say like, "Yeah, you wish, you know," there was nothing like anxiety inducing. The anxiety came when someone, someone from one of these communities, we think from the church, because I worked at the school on one side of the neighborhood and then a church on the weekends. And we think that it was someone from the church saw a post, something online about my wedding in August of 2021, the most beautiful day of my life. It really was. It was an amazing day. And
people get to see that in if you see a communion. So
Our wedding dances. We weave a lot of technical elements in, which is why the cell theater and the developmental production was so important to find that language. I'll tell you after this about one other element that we do that's very key. But you know, somebody reported it, and because of it being public, even though it was on a private platform, it wasn't in the newspaper, it wasn't on TV, it wasn't any of that, right? But that wasn't good enough because somebody had reported it. They had to address it, and their issue was, we have to address the Catholic identity. And the thing that was so compelling to me about this particular story is that normally terminations like this are swift and ruthless. If a woman is pregnant out of wedlock, they come and she's teaching in a school or what, she has a position, she's pretty much fired on the spot, which to me is the most, is even more unjust. What?
Are you serious?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know this.
To me, would be even a more unjust thing, because, unless you were to get married or whatever, but even then, you know, you had a baby out of wedlock. What kind of a minister are you? That's the whole thing. They're able to use the First Amendment of the Constitution to justify their religious discrimination. It's something called Title VII, where if you label an employee as a minister of the faith, then they can legally discriminate, even though in New York State, and you're not allowed to, and you're just not allowed to do this, to fire somebody. But to me, it's so egregious that even with a woman, like, they're bringing a new life into the world and you're going to cut off their income and their health insurance. You want to talk about pro-life?
The irony is like, you know,
right?
You just broke irony with that. Yeah.
One of the things, oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. What did you want to say?
No. I was just affirming the shock of that.
But one of the things that happened when I was called into these meetings is that I found out that there was a committee that was deliberating a high-ranking committee within the Diocese of Brooklyn, made up of the superintendent and some auxiliary bishops and my pastor at the church and my principal at the school and their the diocesan lawyer. All these people were debating on whether I was indeed and was in fact a minister. Is he a minister of the faith?
Mm-hmm.
Because they were really trying, apparently, they were trying to find a way out of this. And when I was called in for the first meeting, I thought I was going in for like an Advent music planning session. It was in like middle of September. And lo and behold, my boss was there with this other woman, a representative from the diocese. And we talked for an hour and they basically told me they wanted to get to the bottom. Was this wedding officially, did it occur in an official capacity within a state? That to them was the cutoff line, because if it had been just some, like, I don't know, some random ceremony on a bed of roses somewhere in the park, like, it wouldn't have mattered to them. But because it was sanctioned within the state of Connecticut, or that's where we were, but which, P.S., there is no in-between civil union law in the state of Connecticut, which is something that the Pope has said, you know, what we need to have is a civil union law, but you cannot get a civil in the state of Connecticut. The only option was, if you want to have legal and financial and all the coverages that so many of our straight brothers and sisters are afforded, the only option is to be married. That's it. Anyway, I was in this meeting where they're telling me this and figuring it out, and somebody had told me on staff, you know, Matt, a couple weeks ago, he called me into his office privately. He's my friend. He said, a couple weeks ago, somebody said, there's somebody made a call about you to the diocese. Somebody. And I said, oh, all right. Well, but nothing's happening. It was just, the seed was planted in my brain. And when I saw this stranger in this meeting, this Advent planning session, I clicked record on my phone.
Mm-hmm.
New York is a one-party consent state anyway, so it's fine.
Yep.
So I clicked record, and just to have as a reference for myself, and I was called in about a month later after I had written letters saying, oh my gosh, pages and pages of letters, arguments to say why I was not a minister necessarily. Mm-hmm. Could we modify my work? What are these are some options, some creative ways to keep my job, to keep my health insurance, to keep my communities. And a month later, after they had reviewed everything, it was not swift and ruthless. Well, it was not swift, but it was pretty ruthless. And I was fired, and I recorded that meeting as well. In the play Communion, we recreate those recordings. Mm-hmm. It's a solo show. I'm the only actor in the show. So I voice all of the characters. I play all of the characters. Mm-hmm. It's really, I mean, as an actor, it's a lot.
Very well done, by the way.
And, oh, thank you.
That's true.
As an employee who was wronged, you know, who was, you know, this is really, it is a trauma. It's a traumatic event. And being able to, you know, inhabit this story fully and say it to people's faces. And a lot of those people who happen to be from those communities have come out to see this. Mm-hmm. It's been very powerful for me. But the way that my sound designer, her name's Julianne Merrill, she is brilliant and wonderful. She's working on that new Barry Manilow show, Harmony, on Broadway right now. And also a new show called How to Dance in Ohio. She was able to figure out how to get my voice into the system, so it sounds like I'm having a real conversation and you believe that there's three people in the room when really it's just me talking to the audio recordings.
It's very well done. The production quality, and you say this is in development, is very well done. I was like, oh my God, this thing is stitched together tightly. And so did you, like, that one conversation where it's the sister and the priest, right? Is that your voices
that's me.
That is
my voices. Okay. And then later there's a deacon, as a deacon, yeah. Who was the bishop's right-hand man, who was called me in, who called me in to officially let me go. And the same friend that called me in and said, hey, like months prior, and said, I think somebody could, you know, just watch out. He told me later, he's like, I was so scared when I saw that deacon. I said, why? Because he's the angel of death. And that's what people call him. He's the guy. That's his job, to go around and carry the bishop's hat. Like, I don't even know what it's called, but to this
mitre,
the mitre, yes, and to accompany him, but also to do like. And I felt, you know, if you can believe it,
it's his job: carry the mitre and fire people. And
right, right, he carried a hatchet too.
Yeah, he had the hatchet, you know.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So
not to make light of the situation, because it's not light at all, but
you know, you have to. And that's one of the things that we explore in the piece.
You do. And you have some humor in there.
Especially at the beginning. And what we wanted was for people to really, you know, go on this ride and to be filled with a sense of safe cushion. Cause that's kind of how I felt. Like, I felt safe in these communities. And I felt loved in these communities. And I say this in the play, I never expected that.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't. I said, you know, I'm just going to have to like kind of keep my mouth shut and just, you know, keep my head down. And then you have people like sticking their head into your office being like, hey, how's life in the closet? And, you know, it's just like,
right.
Like teasing and making fun and being open. And that was part of the safety that we wanted to feel. We wanted to craft in communion, like the joy of being in the choir room and the joy of what it felt like to have these other singers around you and to have people calling you up that were in your choir saying, I'm so happy for you. I sent you a card in the mail. Keep an eye out for that. You know, like to have that so that, as a dramatic, because that really was true. And then to have as a dramatic piece where suddenly same-sex marriage is not approved by the Catholic Church. So, and that's in large part due, I mean, I am obviously the writer of this piece, but I couldn't have done it without Kira Simring, without my director, because she's wonderful with script development and helped me to really line the scenes up so that our audiences go on a journey, which many are saying is very, very powerful.
It is. I wish the run was longer. We'll obviously talk about next steps and how they can help support the program. But I want to, so you know, the string of conversation was about how did you reconcile being a part of the institution that is anti-gay in a lot of ways, about every way. And of course, the marriage and what happened with you and Ron. So, you know, my husband, Roy, he was in a prior 28-year relationship and he passed away. But the point is that Roy converted to Catholicism because of his partner, and they were active in a Catholic parish in New Jersey. And Roy says very similar things to what you do, Matthew, that he felt love, that the two of them were fully a part of the parish community, and just that it was just not even a question about them. And in fact, Roy will share stories about how, because they were in their community, helped others in the parish understand their queer family members and build around that. So it was beyond the institution. So, you know, like he doesn't have remorse about that. And so maybe that's, you know, in the same vein, there's, you know, how you felt as well, because you felt love.
I did. And, you know, this experience, while, you know, I've had an on and off relationship with the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And when I moved to New York, I wasn't really going to church much anymore. And I was looking for other places that I knew would be more open and affirming and in line with what I believed and did not believe in. Because there are some things about the Catholic Church that
For me, I wanted something as authentic to me as possible. And when I started working at the church, you're there 3 or 4 masses a weekend, your options are very limited. Like, there's no other place you can go because you're on the same schedule, right? So it just became kind of like my home and my community, for better or for worse, but in many ways, in a lot of ways, for better. And, even Rowan would say, I really like, you're turning me. I mean, not at this point. We're both like turned off so much. But it was turning him like, I can see what this community is. And they're not so bad. It's not all things that you see in the headlines. And honestly, from church to church that you go to, like when I grew up, I never grew up with any priest that said fire and brimstone. Never.
Mm-hmm.
It's really like the person at the pulpit. And what order of church are you going to? Jesuits and Franciscans.
That's right? True.
That makes a big difference as well. But in college and then even here, like it was never, you're going to hell. There was never mm-hmm. any preaching about that. It was just much more open and affirming overall. So, I feel very fortunate that I never had to wrestle with any of those things that I know that maybe some of your listeners or maybe you gentlemen have had to wrestle with. I grew up in a very tight-knit Italian family, and it was all about family and love and food and community and holidays and tradition. And and then growing up and coming into the theater, like the beauty of community in a theater, one of the things that I say in the play is that the church was my theater, having to be so mm-hmm. theatrical there and put up a bit of a difference, even though I was relatively authentic, but still, you had to act the part a little bit. The church was my theater, but the theater is my church.
I love that.
Yeah, Matthew, there's one character in the play as well, and I think his name is David. The young student. Is it David? Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I felt that that sequence about him is really important.
So I taught elementary school. I taught in the Catholic school up to 8th grade. One of the joys about being an elementary teacher is that you get to see your students grow up and you see who they become. And at the same time, you know what's inside of them. You know who they were. And I'm not a father of my own. And that was something I'm not a father of my own children. And it's something that I had always wanted and never really quite knew how to create, especially financially, because it's so expensive.
Kelly isn't for me. He's like, yes, it is very expensive.
Yes, it is.
Having students and then seeing them on the day that I got fired, I literally ran into one of my former students on the street outside of the church. And he was now he was in his senior year. He was wearing a red sweater from the local Catholic high school. He had just come from like class pictures. And the character in the play is named David. David is, in actuality, that character is an amalgamation of a lot of my students. It's
okay.
One particular student. Okay. But that particular incident did happen. And that particular student that I ran into, I never thought was gay. But in the play, David is unquestionably gay as a high school Catholic senior. And we explore the idea because he's so excited about being a senior year and being at McClancy Catholic High School. And I had him at St. Joseph's in elementary. And he just got into St. John's, which is his first choice for his university career. And Catholic elementary school, Catholic high school, and then a Catholic college. And
did climbing even higher along that road mean for him that there would be just a bigger cliff to fall from? And where the church would leave him to put the pieces back together by himself, and then heave the responsibility onto him, because it was, oh, his choice to do that. It's his choice. I did not choose to be baptized as a Catholic. I was an infant. I did not choose to make any other sacraments of reconciliation or First Communion. And some would say, oh, but you're 13 when you make your confirmation. You choose. I don't know any 13-year-old whose parents, if they're bringing them to the church or in Catholic school, is going to give the child a choice to be, you know, oh, my child needs to be confirmed, because what if they want to get married in the Catholic Church one day, even though the child is going kicking and screaming? And I'm thinking, well, is it them who's going to want to get married in the Catholic Church? Maybe. Or is it you and grandma who really want them to be married in the Catholic Church? What are we really teaching them here? Especially if a child grows up and matures to realize that they are indeed gay. Mm-hmm. And then they have to choose between their faith that they have always known, and that their family and that their family network and their entire community has always known them to be in, and the truth of how God made them. So that character, is very, very important to me to have him there. You know, for a while, this piece was actually a play. And to get it down to the solo show, which we by far think that it is the best way to tell this story, because it just is my story. Yep. I was in the play version. I had multiple actors in it. And I had a character of David's mother.
Oh.
And then I also had the character of my mother. And there were scenes, because my mother, you know, when I came out to her, I was 20 years old, and it was 1995. You all do the math. and she had to take a lot of walks around the block with sunglasses on, and it wasn't even, and it was cloudy out. You know what I mean? So she was nervous that I was going to get AIDS. And my father was sad that I wasn't going to have a family of my own, because I validated that. So, you know, I knew that I always wanted that.
It's exactly my same situation. Same story. It was AIDS in the family.
Yeah, AIDS in the family. But I'm very fortunate that my mother was willing to be open and supportive and choose her son and her family and let her mind stay open and become educated and talk to other mothers. Hey, well, eventually, but talk to other mothers who had gay children. And, you know, what is that? PFLAG? That's a wonderful organization.
Yeah, PFLAG.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, and especially back then where it was needed for her, to the point now where, you know, I was able to write a scene where this is not in the play, but in the solo show, but in the play, like I had her like, open up her shirt like it was like there was a Superman underneath her, and it was like a pride t-shirt underneath, you know, because that's where she's at right now. Like, she loves me, and both she and my father will not stand by a church that does not stand by their son. They realize that no faith has a monopoly on truth. And I tell my mom, I said, listen, you know, you guys are like, you know, you're beyond retirement. You're entering into your twilight years. You need your community. I said, Mom, just go to Catholic Daughters. So she went, she goes to Catholic Daughters now because the ladies are there. They're basically like the Rosary Altar Society. She'll go to that. And I'm glad that she goes to that. I'm especially glad because she just went last week and won the 50-50 raffle. And she gave me the money to put toward my play.
You are blessed.
I am. You know, you were talking about serendipity and synchronicity. Yeah. And there's no question that there have been a lot of angels on my shoulder with this project, that I was able within 6 weeks to get a new teaching job at a, this is very moving to me, but at a, at a public school also in my neighborhood, literally around the corner from me. There was a vacancy for a music teacher, and I'm teaching there now. There was a documentary that was made about this particular story because a documentarian from the School of Visual Arts here in New York City, she saw my story in the New York Times. If anybody wants, by the way, if anybody wants to see more and learn more about this story, I have a website called communiontheplay.com. It has a lot of media links because there was a national media firestorm. I made a video after they said, we're going to give you money. The Diocese of Brooklyn said, we're going to give you money to be quiet about this whole thing. Just, you know, typical corporate thing, right? I said, well, what are you going to do when people ask you about me? Because I live in these neighborhoods. And they said, oh, we'll just have to say that Mr. LaBanca is no longer with us. And I just couldn't, I couldn't stand by that. And I couldn't live with myself if I took $20,000, which was, that's all they were going to give me, which sounds like a lot, like, oh, wow, I could do 20. But that would be gone in New York City. That would be gone in like 3 or 4 months, you know, if that. And then I'd have to be silent for the rest of my life. I was, a lot of people in the neighborhood were connected to Dignity USA, which is a Catholic organization. We're connected to New Ways Ministry, which is another organization.
She does good work.
Right? Yeah. And Mary Ann Eddie Burke, and with GLAAD, my friend Ross Murray at GLAAD, who has still, he's still a part of this project. He led us in a wonderful talk back on our first weekend. But we had a lot of that support. And now that I'm teaching at that other school, like the synchronicity is definitely there. But the media training that I needed, Ross gave it to me. They connected me with Father Jim Martin, which led to the story in the New York Times. The video that I made explaining the story about what happened, I wanted to tell the story once to all the neighbors because, you know, this story affected like over 1,000 people in this neighborhood. And I said, how many times have I told this story? Let me tell it straight from the horse's mouth and put it on YouTube. And P.S., it got like over 25,000 views.
Yeah.
So we were all over the media with that. And we used some of that media within communion, within the story, because it's part of the journey and it's part of the evolution. And hopefully it's part of the building of awareness of the trauma that is inflicted. Gay people don't choose to be gay, no more than straight people choose to be straight. And to be a part of a community and then be told that you cannot be a part of that community is a real trauma. And it was very difficult for me. But I wanted to hold up a mirror to an institution that is clearly, in this regard, doing a lot more harm than good. Sure, they do great work for caring for the poor and other things like that. But, you know, guys, there wasn't there just earlier this week a statement, another opinion statement? It's not law, but it's opinion from the Pope about same-sex marriage. Yes. Yep. I don't know if you were talking about it in another podcast recently, but it just happened. And, you know, there's the Catholic Synod that is happening right now as well. If there's ever been a time to raise our voices, I think now is the time, which is why I said, I don't want to sit on this project. I want to get it out there. I want to see what effect it could have. And not just within the five boroughs of New York City, but I would want this piece. Because it has the power, you know, they say that who changes the world? It's the actors and the writers in whatever capacity. You know, a lot of people act and a lot of people tell stories and a lot of people write and a lot of people share. You know, the pen is mightier than the sword, so to speak. And I wanted to be a part of a piece that could possibly shift hearts and minds. I've been working as an actor in the theater for almost 30 years and when this happened to me, I think there are no coincidences. Using all the skills that have led me to this point as an actor, as a writer, as a teacher, as a storyteller, as a gay man, and as a Catholic, which I don't know that I so proudly wear that banner anymore. But my faith in God has not been rocked. If for no other reason than is evidenced by the beautiful synchronicity that's ushered forth from this product. You know, they say that the church spoke and they made their decision. The church spoke, but I think that God answered and God is answering right now. through me and through you gentlemen as well with the wonderful work that you're doing.
My heart is so full listening to this. Thank you. Thank you. I feel like I've been to church today.
Oh, can I say this too? Because I love that you said that, because it's, that was one of the things that we wanted to get across with communion, that the church uses the idea of ministerial exception. And yeah. That to label you as a minister, to say that you can no longer act as in a ministerial capacity within this church, because you are a minister of the faith and you went against our tenets.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so in the letters that I wrote, I denied being a minister. I said, well, I'm not really a minister. So much of what I teach is music. I'd be doing that in a public school, right? I tried every which way to deny that I'm a minister. And yet here I am with this piece. And it's its own ministry.
Indeed it is. And I love the fact that you acknowledge that, because one of the questions I asked you in my email that I sent over is, do you see this as a calling?
Oh, no question. Absolutely.
No question. It's a rhetorical question, but I'm so glad you affirm it to be a ministry, because yes, synchronicity in bringing us together in this conversation, but also you are the example of many who we are the church, and the church begins from bottom up, not top down. And unfortunately, many, not just the Roman Catholic church, have twisted that around, you know, because it's a patriarchy, it's a magisterium, it's all those things, you know, to keep the institution going. And but yet, you know, you are an example of, we can live outside of the church and still carry out what is our faith fully and authentically and wholly and in all of that. And
One of the first things that happens in a Catholic Mass is the Confiteor prayer, I confess to Almighty God, and you obey, you atone, right? Yeah. Well, we do that as individuals, but institutions can atone.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Well, if they don't, they are going to die. I don't know how they survive, but that's another conversation. But you know, you are the life through communion. Matthew, also, I want to thank you for sharing a little bit about the history of communion. You know, it's not told about that there was a play version of this. What you've created is what I saw was the one man. One person solo of you, and in it, what I think is perfection, basically, of telling a story and sharing this. I can't imagine this other as a play. I just, as you were sharing about, you know, whether there was a, you know, you had your a character of your mother or of David's mother, and I thought, I don't see that. So well done.
Thank you. You know, the stuff, the artistic process is not linear, and you just figure things out, right? No. So, but I think that we've stumbled on something very, very special. And I agree. It's the way to tell this story.
Mm. Well, I really hope that the world gets to see more of it, and that our listeners will seek out the website and the documentary. And we wait with anticipation to see what's next for you.
Thank you. You know, we want to keep continuing to tell this story. Is it all right if I mention about those efforts, what we're trying to do?
Go wild, my friend.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay, thank you. But you can find this on our website, but we do have a GoFundMe page. And the GoFundMe, if you read through it, and the website is communiontheplay.com. Communiontheplay.com, all one word. And it just shares about how, if we were to have a presentation of communion that was a larger, more robust incarnation, whatever that looks like. Some might say that it's an off-Broadway show. Some might say that it's a streaming version of it. It's a filmed version of it, or something bigger like that. But we're assembling. We have some people already on our team, but creatives especially. But we're assembling investors. We're assembling producers, and we want to give it as much of a life as possible, because we think that it could have a tremendous impact on the world. So if you want to support the effort, you could go to communiontheplay.com. You could click on the donate button. You could explore the GoFundMe, explore all the articles that were written. I mean, it's a very legitimate project. It's been written about in playbill.com and broadwayworld.com, and has been reviewed several times, even just as a developmental production. So we think that, and we hope, and I should say, we know this is just the beginning.
Yes.
I love it.
I love it.
Thank you.
Matthew, thank you for just a beautiful conversation. God, you are just living out your faith. That is for sure. Kelly, wow. Wow.
Yeah, I'm so moved and blown away, and I'm walking away from this conversation inspired. So I'm really, really glad that you're here today, that we got to meet and talk, I really appreciate this conversation.
Pleasure was mine, gentlemen. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Matthew. Thanks for listening to this episode of Radical Love Live, co-hosted by Mark Dilcom and Kelly Wilson. All rights reserved. You can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, and other popular podcast platforms. Go to radicallovelive.com to learn more about us, watch recordings of our live events, and listen to our podcast. We also invite you to check out what Kelly and Mark are doing by going to our websites. Find Kelly at kellywilson.com and Mark at markdilcom.com. This is Radical Love Live, where we explore faith outside the boxes.